Hello and welcome to Launch. We are broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Ron Reardon. My co-host Bill McHenry is on vacation, but our trusty producer Lee Cantor is here in his place. Thanks for filling in today, Lee. How are you doing?
I am doing great. Loving the summer weather. Everything is A-OK on my end.
I tell you what, and it's a little bit cooler today than normally, so it's not going to be just sweltering.
There you go. I like sweltering. I'm from Miami, so sweltering works for me.
Okay. Not me. I like it cool. Well, Lee, you know, in Launch, we focus on the launching of a business, the planning that precedes the launch, and the victories and the setbacks that occur after that launch, so that innovators, entrepreneurs, product developers can learn from the successes and the failures of launching an idea and the journey that follows. This morning, we're featuring Lewis Foreman of Inventus, but before we get started, Lee, could you thank today's sponsor?
Our sponsor today is Patents & More. Patents & More, protecting your innovation and connecting you to the resources you need for success.
I agree. Well, you know, Lewis Foreman's the founder and chief executive of Inventus, which is an integrated product design and engineering firm with offices in Charlotte, North Carolina, and Taiwan. And, you know, Lewis is the creator of the Emmy award-winning PBS TV show Everyday Edisons. He's also the publisher of Inventor's Digest. In July of this year, his first book, The Inventor's Independent Inventor's Handbook, was published. Back in 2008, he was appointed by the Secretary of Commerce to serve a three-year term on PPAC, which is the Patent Public Advisory Committee for the United States Patent and Trademark Office. So, Lewis, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be with you today.
Okay. I understand that, you know, you're also been, you've created 9 successful startups. You've been directly responsible for the creation of 20 others. You're a prolific inventor of 10 registered U.S. patents, and the firm you've got is responsible for the development filing of well over 400 more. So you've been involved with a lot of startups.
I live and breathe startups. I started my first business out of my fraternity room in college 20 years ago and have never looked back.
Okay, well, let's go back to that first company.
Did it involve beer, that first one?
No, you know, it was something that was legal. And it was one of those interesting situations. I was taking economics my freshman year in college, and I learned something about supply and demand. When you have demand for a product or a service and no one's really meeting that demand, there's a business opportunity. And in my situation, I played lacrosse at the university, and there wasn't a local supplier of that equipment. So it dawned on me that here you had a team that needed equipment, but you didn't have a local supplier, so there was a business opportunity. And I seized that opportunity and started my first company out of my fraternity room.
And so it had to do with lacrosse?
It did. You know, talk about a niche market. The first business was selling equipment. So not only did I sell, you know, sticks and balls and gloves and shoulder pads and other equipment to my team, but also to teams throughout the area. And, you know, it started off real small, but then eventually grew into apparel where those teams also needed uniforms and bags and hats, and eventually evolved into the 25th largest apparel manufacturing company in the U.S.
That's pretty incredible because, you know, I think most people, you know, when you say lacrosse, they're like, and what is that? Is that a pen or what?
Right.
Okay. So, but yeah, you did identify a really great niche. So what was your thought process there at the beginning? I mean, you saw the opportunity and you saw the profit margins could be good and...
Yeah, it was a little bit of all of that. You know, first off, there was an opportunity, and so it seemed like a great fit to seize that opportunity. It was also a real-world education. You know, being a student, I was able to apply some of the practical knowledge that I was learning in school to real-world situations. But most importantly, you know, there's something gratifying about creating something from scratch and knowing that you're creating value and jobs and hopefully an economic return in the process.
Yeah, that's incredible. I've always been amazed at the power of just one person. You know, when you look at all the industries that have been created by somebody like Ted Turner or Steve Jobs, you know, it's just amazing, you know, how much it's benefited the economy.
Well, you know, our country has always been a leader in the area of innovation and job creation through entrepreneurial endeavors. And, you know, given the current economic circumstances that we're in right now, we need small business job creation more than we've ever needed it before. And there are really great opportunities out there for individuals to go out and start a business, whether it be around a product or a service, but you also need to do it responsibly. You want to limit the risk and hopefully, you know, create something that has value.
Yeah, and when you look at eliminating risk, because, you know, when I talk to inventors, I tell them that while the odds are better than the lottery, there's still kind of slim odds of being successful, you know, in a startup business.
Yeah, you know, when you look at the odds overall, about 50% of businesses are successful and another 50% fail. But you can work the odds to your favor by really determining the feasibility of the idea before you get started. What I've experienced over the years through my teaching is that entrepreneurs tend to be somewhat headstrong. They're sometimes very impatient. They want to get out there and prove that there's an opportunity. And sometimes they don't do all the packing or all the preparation that they need to do before they get started. And a lot of the failures that we see could have been avoided if they just would have taken their time and really assessed the situation before they jumped in.
You know, and you cover a lot of that in your book, the Independent Inventor's Handbook. So, you know, if you had somebody coming to you that had an idea for a startup, you know, what would be the first advice that you would give them?
Well, you know, I try to boil it down to five questions. And the first question is really probably the most important, and that is, what is unique about the product or the service that you're going to offer? The fact is, as a society, we have everything we need. I mean, we can live the rest of our lives without any new products or any new services from any entrepreneurial startups. But as a society, we want to go out and buy things that make our life better or more enjoyable or more efficient. So the first thing you really need to do is determine what is it about your product or the service that is different than what's already out there. What's the value proposition? Why will people buy it? Then, once you've really defined the unique aspect of the product, who's the customer for this? And don't say everybody in the world, because it's not realistic, but who's the perfect customer that's going to buy this product? Third, you want to determine whether or not there's actually demand. So if you know who that customer is, talk with them. Find out what spurs that purchasing decision. How much would they pay for it? Where would they expect to buy it? How long should it last? Do they really like what you're offering them? And then you've got to figure out whether or not you can make money in it. Because sometimes you could have a great idea, but there's not an economic return that can be made off of it. Maybe the product's too expensive, or the market's just not big enough to produce enough revenue to offset the investment you're going to make to bring it to market. And then finally, after you've done all those four questions, you've got to figure out where that money's going to come from. So if you're going to get started, make sure you've identified where the capital is going to come from before you begin the process. Because what you don't want to do is get halfway into it, run out of money, and then realize that you don't have enough to get you to where you're going.
Yeah, I remember reading an article that the American Bar Association put out for entrepreneurs, and they said the two areas that the most entrepreneurs really underestimate is how much money it's going to take, you know, for the business to go the distance and get traction, and also how much time it's going to take.
It does. You know, and we're all optimistic in the process. I mean, we'd like to believe that the market is going to embrace our product and they're going to line up outside of our door to buy our product or our service. But in reality, it takes time to get traction. It takes money, and sometimes it takes more money and more time than what we originally envisioned. So you want to make sure that you've got, you know, some margin for error. If you're playing it really close, I mean, if you've got 3 months worth of cash and then you're out, don't get started. I mean, what you want to make sure is that there's a good opportunity that you can make money in the process. And if you can't, then don't jump in. Wait for better market conditions, wait for greater market demand, or wait for the next great idea that's going to be much more successful.
Yeah, because I know that a lot of times when you look at people's business plans and their projections on sales and everything, that at the very heart of their assumptions is, well, if we can just get 1% of the market, you know, we're going to be successful, and, you know, we'll do that in the first year. Have you seen charts like that?
I have, and it always concerns me when the diligence that an inventor or an entrepreneur does is that they define a market by the size of the market. So they'll say, well, I've got a pet product, and the pet industry is a $9 billion industry, and if I could just get 1% of that $9 billion industry, then I'm generating $90 million in sales. Now, in reality, $9 billion, it's not of their product. I mean, that encompasses everything from food to grooming to boarding to toys to vet bills. So it really isn't a $9 billion market that you're going after. If you've got a pet toy, maybe it's only a couple $100 million market. And then to expect that you're going to get 1% of the market, I mean, maybe it's less than that, or maybe it's more. So what you really need to do is define who your customer is and quantify how many of those customers exist, and then do some market research and find out if they really like it.
Yeah, not only do they really like it, but how are they going to be aware of your product?
Right, and how much will they pay for it? I mean, what you may find is that there's a great market, there's a lot of consumers, they really like your product, but when you tell them that it's going to cost $100 and their expectations are that they'd pay $20, there's a big disconnect there. And so, you know, sometimes you could have a great product, but you can't deliver it at a price where consumers are willing to buy it.
Yeah, that's true. We had some inventors here in Atlanta that their second product was tremendously successful, but their first one was a total flop. And the reason it was a flop was because it was something for the industry where they straighten hair and everything, and it was a great big complicated device that the people that were using it in the salon loved it, but they were not willing to pay the price that they needed in order to sell it. And they finally had to just walk away from it and lost their shirt and their family's shirts and everything else. But luckily their second product, you know, was enormously successful.
Well, sometimes you get lucky in the process and you learn from your mistakes. Sometimes people can't recover from the first mistake. They lose everything that they've got. You know, they lose their home and they lose their savings. And all they needed to do was some simple preparation on the front end to find out that there just isn't a market for it.
Right. Well, you know, once an entrepreneur has defined the market and everything looks like the planets are aligning and all like that, your book talks about building an effective pitch. What all goes into that?
Well, you know, I think what you've got to be able to do is define what the opportunity is and make it simple enough for people to understand it. You don't want to go in overly optimistic and make it seem like everyone in the world is going to benefit from your product. What you really need to do is be able to define the unique aspect of the product. Why is it different than what's already out there that's satisfying the basic core needs of the consumer? Why are you uniquely qualified to be able to produce or to market this product? And then, can you generate an economic return for not only you, but also for the investors? I mean, at the end of the day, you got to make money in the process. And so if you can boil it down to just those simple three aspects, you're going to know very quickly whether or not it resonates or it doesn't.
Yeah, I know, because from an investor standpoint, they really could care less about the product. They want to know about the business behind the product.
Yeah, you know, in many cases, investors are, they're obviously looking to generate a return, but they're also investing in your ability to execute on the plan. I mean, I've seen, and I'm sure you have as well, Ron, you know, not such great products, but they do really well because there's a great management team behind it or a really strong brand or really strong distribution. And then at the same time, I've seen products that are amazing, but they never do well because the team behind it just isn't capable of executing on the plan.
Yeah, that's true. And when you talk about team, you know, a lot of inventors kind of adhere to the John Wayne approach to inventing. you know, that they can do it all themselves, you know, the rugged American, and not realizing that they really have to have some folks with them that can do the things that they can't do.
That's such a great point, Ron. You need to surround yourself with great people. And that starts at the very beginning when you're finding a good patent attorney or patent agent to protect the idea, through all of the development, the marketing, the branding. Inventing or being an entrepreneur, it's not a solo sport. It's not something you have to do all by yourself. What you want to do is make sure that you surround yourself with the people who complement your skills. So if you're a great sales guy, if you can go out there and make the sale, but you're not really good with the day-to-day operational aspects of the business, then find someone who is. Or if you're very technical and you're the one who can really develop the product and handle the manufacturing aspect of it, but you're uncomfortable pitching it to prospective customers, then find someone who complements you in that respect. But don't try doing it all yourself, because owning 100% of something very small is not nearly as great as owning a smaller percentage of something that's huge.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how a person goes about that, partnering with somebody? Because that sounds good just on the surface. Yeah, find somebody that fills in your gaps. But how do they, like, say you're an inventor and you come up with something, how do you structure these kind of arrangements, these partnerships? Are you giving it, does it become a 50-50 partnership, or are you giving up a small piece of equity in exchange for their help? And how do you know which things are worth, you know, what in terms of moving the ball for the whole project?
Sure. I think that's a great question. And, you know, there's not a simple answer, unfortunately, because it really just depends on what the need is and the size of the company and what the value of the service they're providing. But it could run the gamut from surrounding yourself with good people that you just hire to do it, right? So you don't necessarily have to give an attorney or a patent agent equity in your business to do what they do. You just need to go out and hire a really good one to do what they do. But at the same time, you may find that having those individuals have some skin in the game, where they've got a vested interest in the success of the business, may be advantageous as well. The best way that I know to value that is to determine what is the value of their service. So if you've got someone who's going to be providing some design services or marketing services or sales assistance, what's the value of that service if you were just to pay them cash? And then what is the value of your overall company? And so if someone's giving you $50,000 worth of services and the value of your company is worth $500,000, well, then it equates to about 10% of the value of your company. So anything in the 10% equity range would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, that sounds on target. You know, Lewis, I've always been fascinated by when you look at a successful company and you go back to their origins of exactly, you know, how they progressed from being, you know, really small, one-person shop, and then they started adding team and started getting some traction and finally get to the tipping point to where it takes off. And, you know, before the show, Lee and I were talking about one story that I'm familiar with has to do with a nail polish called Hard Candy. Many years ago, I read that this young girl basically was taking existing nail polishes and she was mixing the colors and rebottling them and calling them really strange names and selling them in little bitty boutiques. And they were unique colors and unique names and, you know, had kind of a niche market. But it started getting some real traction, and it got to the point where she couldn't handle the volume. And everything, and she ended up hiring a retired CEO of a large company to, you know, please help me as this thing's expanding, because I can't handle it anymore. And I noticed just a couple weeks ago, I was in Walmart, and here's this whole section in the cosmetics area for Hard Candy. I'm like, oh my goodness, I remember when this thing started.
Yeah, so some of the greatest businesses started really small with an individual with a great idea. The ones that tend to scale up, you know, very quickly are the ones that recognize that they can't do it all by themselves. And so whether they go out and they hire great talent, or they align with that talent and maybe, you know, bring them on as investors or partners, the bottom line is you want to get that team built, and you want to get the right people who can help you get to where you're going.
So who are the people on your team? Like, what would you start? If you're an inventor, who are the, like, first one to three people you would look to work with?
Well, I think you need someone who's good from a sales standpoint. I mean, sales is really critical in the process of any business. You've got to go out there and you got to generate business. So you want to have someone on your team who is comfortable representing the company and going out and getting the business. You want to have a good operations person, someone who understands the day-to-day minutiae of running the company. And it's good to have someone from a finance standpoint, you know, someone who understands cash flow, who understands accounting, someone who can manage the day-to-day financial activities of the business. If you've got those three pieces in place, then, you know, hiring an attorney, hiring people for marketing and branding and product design and engineering and all that, those are services that are readily abundant that you can go out and you can hire people to do that. But if you, the perfect dream team would be sales, operations, finance. If you got those three pieces in place, you've got a great foundation.
Okay, and I guess the way that I would look at it is Mr. Outside, Mr. Inside, and Finance.
And Mr. Money.
Right. Yeah, okay, yeah, right. Mr. Outside, Mr. Inside, and Mr. Money. Okay. I always like to reduce things to terms I can understand.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily always have to make those individuals partners. You could always hire a good accountant, and you can always hire a good salesperson, or you can hire a good operations person. But, you know, there's something comforting knowing that you've got partners in a business, you know, that you've got people who are helping you kind of carry the load. They've got a vested interest, and that, you know, although they will share in the upside, hopefully they've got a golden handcuff that keeps them, you know, close to the business and committed to achieving success because they're going to benefit, you know, personally from that success.
Yeah, I'm thinking back to a meeting I attended where one of the founders of Scientific Atlanta was talking about their beginning, and it was basically five engineers that each put up $500 to start Scientific Atlanta. Okay.
Nice.
Yeah, and you look at it, you know, today, I think they've been acquired by Cisco recently, and but to think back, you know, it was just five guys, $500, you know, and they're all engineers.
Well, did you read that there was somebody from Apple that was, like, bought out for $800, like, really early on?
No, I haven't heard that story.
Yeah, that was an interesting story. He had put up some of the initial money for the business and then ended up selling out because he was concerned that the business was going to fail. And he had personally guaranteed some of the debt of the company. And because he was the oldest and had the greatest assets, he was worried that, you know, he was going to have to, you know, kind of pay back all the money that they had borrowed. So he exited, and of course, his mistake, you know, cost him billions of dollars.
Yeah, I've heard quite a few stories like that. I remember they interviewed Art Linkletter once, and they said, you know, you've been real successful in your life. Is there anything that you really regret? And he says, yeah, there was one decision I made I really regret. This guy called Walt Disney came to me wanting an investment in this silly theme park he was going to put together, and I turned him down. Oh, it's incredible. And I've heard the same story about the two guys came into a clerk at the hotel saying, we've got an idea for starting a business, and here it is, you know, on the back of this envelope. And the guy looked at it and says, you guys are crazy. That will absolutely never work. You're not going to get any money out of me. And he turned down the opportunity to have one-third of Hertz rent a car.
I'm sure there's the...
Well, hindsight is 20/20. And I'm sure we all have a mulligan that we'd like to use at some point.
But your book talks about how the person can begin this whole thing and become that success story, right? The independent inventor.
Yeah, family. You know, the book is really practical information. It really explains the process of going from that eureka moment where you've got that great idea to how do you exit, whether you license the idea or you build a business around it. And so what we've tried to do with the book is really frame it around stories of other successful and non-successful inventors. So you kind of learn from their successes, you learn from their failures, and you get the information that you need to make a good decision in the process.
Yeah, I was looking at the cover of your book, and it's got, you know, 10 things not to tell a potential investor. I'm not going to make you go through all 10, but what would be some of the top three things that you just absolutely don't tell a potential investor?
Well, you know, first off, you don't want to use that example like, boy, if I just get 1% of, you know, the $9 billion industry, because they're going to see right through that and realize that you haven't done your research. You really don't know the market. But, you know, there are simple things. You know, you don't want to try posturing or lying to an investor by saying that, you know, you've got all sorts of interest in your business if you really don't, because they'll call your bluff on it.
Yep. They talk to each other.
You want to make sure that the financials you put in place are realistic. I mean, don't make the numbers work to get a return that the investor is looking for if you're not going to actually be able to deliver that return.
Okay. If you say something like, we have no competition, will the investors start running away?
Oh, absolutely, because every product, every service has some competition. It may not be direct competition, but there's something out there that consumers are currently buying and consuming that addresses the basic core needs, you know, of what they've got. So if your great idea is to create, you know, a new energy drink, well, obviously there's lots of energy drinks out there, but even if the energy drinks that are out there aren't exactly like yours, there's water and there's Gatorade and there's soda. So, you know, our basic core need is we have to be hydrated, whether it's in an expensive energy drink or it's a basic bottle of water or just drinking, you know, off the tap. Those needs are already being met. So why is it that your product is better than what's already out there? There's competition for everything.
Okay. Well, you know, as a product developer or inventor, you know, starts off and they're looking at the decision, do I start a company, do I license? Most of them seem to gravitate towards licensing because, you know, it's less risk and less investment. But what are some of the top licensing landmines that an inventor ought to avoid?
Well, licensing is a great way to monetize an idea or a patent without making the significant investment in inventory and manufacturing and distribution. It's all about risk and reward. So you're assuming less risk when you license your product, and in exchange, you're somewhat limiting the amount of your reward. But from a licensing standpoint, what you want to do is you want to make sure, first off, that you work with a reputable company, a company that, you know, has a good track record of actually following through with what they say they're going to do. Make sure you get an attorney or an advisor involved from the very beginning in drafting the license agreement. I've seen in so many situations inventors get so excited that they've got an agreement and they've got this generous royalty amount, but then there's no guaranteed minimums or there's no term to the agreement or there's no upfront payment. And so theoretically, a company could license your idea, never manufacture it, never commercialize it, but keep you out of the market because they have an exclusive license to your product with no minimums. So you want to make sure you get some sort of minimum annual payment. You want to try getting some money up front if you can, but it's not necessarily a deal killer. And you want to make sure that there's a term to the agreement, that, you know, whether it's a year or 3 years or 5 years, with some provision to extend it if they're meeting minimum expectations. It's a partnership, and what you want to do is you want to make sure that you find a partner that you're compatible with.
And so you also have to have a way out. So if they are not performing, then you're still protected.
Yeah, typically, you know, if you were to license your intellectual property for 3 years, there would be certain minimums that would be, you know, required each year. And if they don't meet those minimums, then everything would revert back to you. At the end of 3 years, you know, you would have the option to renew the agreement, or maybe there's a provision that as long as they're meeting certain, you know, thresholds, then the agreement continues to renew on an evergreen basis, you know, year after year, as long as they're achieving the results that you're looking for. But what you don't want to do is turn everything over to them without any assurances, because you could literally be locked out of the market.
Yeah, there's an inventor here in Atlanta that I'm familiar with that has successfully licensed her products for quite many, many, many years. But her first license agreement, all the mistakes you just mentioned, she made every single one of them. Okay, there was no term, there was no minimums, there was no upfront money, and they basically licensed it, put it on the shelf, and it took her years to get out of that.
But again, it comes down to surrounding yourself with good people. And my guess, and I don't know this particular inventor, but my guess is that she probably didn't have either advice from counsel or competent counsel to really help her in that process. Because, a good attorney would point these obvious issues out to her.
Yeah, she did it all herself on the first one. Then she learned.
That's right. It's a tuition payment.
Yeah, my wife.
You learn in the process.
My wife keeps telling me that I've had a very expensive education.
Right. But, well, and if you're learning from these failures, then you can chalk that up to tuition. You can say, well, I learned something from this, and I'm going to not make that same mistake again. What is just not possible is to continue to make the same mistakes over and over again and expect that, you're going to have a different outcome. So what you need to do is just, again, surround yourself with good people, learn from successes, learn from failures, and make sure that you're ready, to be successful from the very beginning.
Right. Well, talking about learnings, this is the third season of Everyday Edisons. What have you personally learned, through three seasons of this?
Well, what we're finding out there is that there is an incredible appetite from major manufacturers and retailers to work with inventors. They're looking for new ideas. Innovation is the buzzword out there. Companies are desperate to bring new and exciting products to market. The problem is that sometimes they don't speak the same language as the inventors, and not literal language, but it's about expectations. Inventors want to believe that their ideas are worth millions of dollars, and eventually those ideas may be worth millions of dollars, but when you're trying to license or align with a major manufacturer or retailer, there's a lot of risk that they're assuming as well. And so we have, this season of the show, we've had some products that have been licensed. We've got some products that are going into retail. And we're finding through Edison Nation that there's just an incredible appetite for these companies to engage in dialogue with inventors to find new ideas. So it's a great time to be an inventor.
Yeah, I've noticed that the environment really seems to have changed because many years ago, big corporations just did not want to deal with individual inventors. And I think after Procter & Gamble got open innovation going and had some good successes with that, the attitude with big companies, with product cuts and everything, has really transformed.
It is. Two things have really happened. One is that the cycle from kind of introducing new products has shortened significantly. It used to be where products may be redesigned or new line extensions came out every couple years. Now they come out almost every year. Just look on the store shelves and look at how many new versions of products exist. And it's because it's our fault, right? As consumers, we expect everything to be new and improved. So as a result, manufacturers and retailers are constantly bringing out new versions. And as a result, there's only so much they can do internally, and sometimes those great ideas come from outside. And so P&G was one of the first to really recognize just how valuable the outside world was. Even though they're one of the largest R&D companies in the world, they represent such a small percent of the total R&D effort that A.G. Lafley, who was the chairman at the time, said, let's open up our doors. Let's look outside of our corporate campus and find great ideas. And Swiffer is a great example of that. They didn't invent Swiffer. It was found by a P&G employee's wife in Asia, and that's grown to be what is now almost a $1 billion brand for them.
That's incredible. I did not know that story. That's something.
Now, you've been involved in inventing all aspects of this for a long, long time. Is it something where you can tell at a glance if something's going to be successful or not?
You know, I wish I could. I'd like to say that I've got pretty good radar, and I'm able to detect ideas that have value. But, you know, the first season of our casting calls back in 2005, someone brought us a blanket that had sleeves in it.
And you passed?
And we didn't see the value. We laughed at it. We thought it was pretty funny. But we're thinking, who is going to buy a blanket with sleeves just to be able to control the remote, you know, without getting out from underneath the blanket? And, you know, almost $1 billion in sales later, you know, the Snuggies is doing pretty well without us.
That's right. Well, I know that one product that I've seen that you've been involved in has to do with cats, you know, sharpening their claws. What was the name of that?
Yeah, that product is called Emery Cat, and it came to our second season casting call. Michael Deep is a Vietnamese guy from California, had this great idea, but didn't know what to do with it. He came to our casting call with a 2x4 that was covered in sandpaper and carpeting. And his concept was make a cat scratching toy that cats will scratch at and as a result will file their nails. And so over the season of Everyday Edisons, we transformed that 2x4 into a plastic molded base with a corrugated insert that is infused with sand, and it launched at PetSmart initially, and then from there we took it on TV, and so we did some direct response TV spots, and then in the beginning of this year it launched nationally at Walmart and Walgreens and Rite Aid and CVS and Best Buy and PetSmart and Bed Bath, I mean pretty much everywhere. And it's a product that's doing phenomenally well.
Yeah, the first time I saw that was in Inventor's Digest, you know, which you're the publisher of. You know, I've been a subscriber of that since 2002, and I think it's the finest magazine for inventors on the planet. So tell me a little bit about Inventor's Digest.
Well, the publication has been around. We're celebrating our 25th year, and it's the only publication devoted to idea people. It's a monthly publication, and it's just a nice resource for people to have. You learn from both success and failure. And so we try to celebrate the successes of inventors. We try to point out the issues that cause failure. And you learn from it. You learn about the various aspects of the invention process.
Yeah, I enjoy reading it cover to cover, every single article, every month when it comes in.
Well, you know, I think the staff of Inventor's Digest does a great job of, you know, putting together interesting stories, interesting information, and doing it in a way that, you know, people are excited to get it in their mailbox and sit down and read it.
Yeah. Well, Lewis, this has been great. How can our listeners get in touch with you if they want to learn more about Inventus and the other items that you do?
Well, they can always reach me at inventus.com, which is Enventys.com. Or Edison Nation is an online community that we started, and you can become my friend. It's kind of like Facebook, but it's for idea people. And so you learn from other people, and you can network on this site, and you can find different services and product opportunities. So if you go to edisonnation.com, you can join. It's free to join, and then just make me your friend. And then you have a kind of an open conduit to reach me whenever you need to.
Okay, that's been super. Well, Lewis, thanks for being on our show today. Our listeners have gotten some really great nuggets and learnings that they can use in their launch and their journey.
Well, thank you, Ronnie. It was great great talking with you again.
Okay, super. It's another great show, Lee.
Special thanks to today's sponsor, Patents & More, your trusted guide through the innovation jungle.
And tune in this week at the same time to listen live, or go to our blog at thelaunchhour.businessradiox.com to listen at your convenience. Bill McHenry will be back next week for another great session of Launch.